I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is writer Bruce Feiler, the author of Walking the Bible on his new book, The Secrets of Happy Families. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Spring has sprung here in the great Southwest where I live, bringing with it March madness, flowers, allergies, and even a touch of humidity. For those of you listening in from the colder climes of our country or our world, my condolences, but the weather here in Tucson and southern Arizona has been simply gorgeous, bringing the kinds of days that embrace you and make it feel good to be alive. A bit of wind, even an occasional rain shower, and a lovely green tint to the hills and mountains mark this as perhaps the prettiest season of all in the Sonoran Desert. All of which makes the fact that this is also the season of Passover spring cleaning and full-on preparations even more of a cognitive dissonance. At a time of loveliness everywhere, we Jews have to clear out our closets, clean out all the chametz, the leavened products, sweep and dust and vacuum and wash and remove all the stuff that's accrued in our lives since the end of Pesach last year. But of course, Passover is a springtime festival. In fact, one of its four names is Chag HaAviv, the holiday of the spring. So doing our Jewish version of spring cleaning is totally appropriate, no matter how arduous it might seem right now, just 2 weeks and 1 day or two before Pesach. You know, undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led us to create the holiday of Passover. Spring is celebrated in every culture and nearly every religion. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal we will hold the first two nights of Pesach that teaches the meaning and story of freedom in a rich and wonderful variety of ways, spring is featured in the green vegetables we dip in salt water, in the hard-boiled egg that symbolizes the rebirth of spring. The magnificent love poem Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is chanted on Passover, filled with images of gardens and growth and love in the flowering springtime. A wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of seasons. Until, of course, we realize yet again that we have to clean, cook, and basically work ourselves to the bone preparing for the ultimate festival of freedom. And if, like me and my wife Wendy, you are hosting a sizable Seder the first night of Passover, you know that you are purchasing Pesach food supplies, cleaning, removing the leavened material, preparing all the delicious and hard-to-make foods for the complicated meal without your regular stuff, plus preparing all the ritual foods too, and generally working a second full-time job in the kitchen and as a cleaning slave, preparing for the holiday of liberation. It's as though we work like our ancestors did in Egyptian slavery just so we can fully appreciate the joy of freedom. Still, it's a beautiful time of year, and more people celebrate Pesach than just about any Jewish holiday or ritual the whole rest of the year. So, to play us in this morning, here's some more of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music. It's a song about, well, matzah, unsurprisingly, I suppose, from the Seder. We'll celebrate a couple of weeks from Monday night. Halachma Anya, this is the bread of affliction that our ancestors ate when they left the land of Egypt. Let all who are hungry come and eat. In a madrigal version from the Western Winds, Halachma Anya.
Call the spirit of the
That was the Western Winds version of Halach Ma'anya, Matzah, the Bread of Affliction. By the way, do you know what you call somebody who loves eating unleavened bread? A matzakist. Get it? Combination of matzah and masochist. Never mind. Anyway, just continue to prepare to enjoy eating matzah in 2 weeks, beginning April 14th. You know, it's not so frequently that tax day is also the first day of Passover, but when you can combine taxes and eating matzah, you really do have a sense of affliction, a reminder of slavery in Egypt, don't you? Actually, I believe that in my own congregation, there are probably more people who like matzah than those like me who really, really don't. So I shouldn't be so critical of this bread of affliction that tastes just like the box it comes in. It does work extremely well as sandpaper in a pinch. Anyway, in happier news, Bruce Feiler has walked the Bible, written 6 consecutive New York Times best-selling books, including The Council of Dads, and he will be here in a couple of moments. His newest book journeys over different territory, but complex and important too, Happy Families. Find out what he discovered about their secrets when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. He's author Bruce Feiler, most famous perhaps for Walking the Bible, but a New York Times best-selling author with, boy, is it 4 or 5 consecutive New York Times bestsellers now?
Oh, it's 6, but who's counting other than my mother?
Your mother, I'm sure. Bruce writes a column on contemporary family life for the New York Times, and he has written, in addition to Walking the Bible, The Council of Dads, which we also spoke about here on Too Jewish. He hosted several PBS series, is a frequent contributor to ABC, NBC, CBS, NPR, and lots of other initials. Good morning and welcome.
It's great to be with you again. Thank you.
So tell us, why did you decide to write a book about the secrets of happy families?
Well, my wife insisted, as I was picking up the phone to chat with you, that I say that I was writing about happy families, not because I had one, but because I wanted one. And I think that really gets to the heart of this project, and I think actually why it's reached a lot of people, because parents today are out of control. We all feel chaotic. We feel that we're playing defense all the time. And, you know, we want to be building a family culture. We want our families to be closer. But there's this idea that we're just supposed to magically know how to do this. But actually, we don't. And so what I tried to do was go out, get the best ideas, talk to the most creative people, some in the family space, but many not in the family space, and really try to answer a question, which is, what is it that happy families are doing right, and what can I learn from them to make my family happier?
You know, I remember a line from the movie Parenthood, which described how you needed a license to catch a fish, but any, I'm going to paraphrase, idiot could become a father. You wrote about fatherhood when, of course, you had that sort of a terrible health scare and were experiencing sort of what fatherhood meant in case you weren't around. Thank God you are around. What have you learned about the complexity of parenting? What's the single most important thing?
We all have our jobs, and we know we have to work to get better at those. We have our hobbies. We know our tennis game isn't going to get better, or our garden is not going to get greener unless we work on that. We know we have to work on our bodies, and we even have all learned we have to work on our relationships. And yet our families, which we know nothing is more important to our overall happiness than our relationship with other people. And yet we keep putting our families to the end of the line because we're exhausted, because we're stressed, because we don't really know what to do. And so I guess the number one thing I've learned is that the most important thing is if you take small steps, look at what's working out there, try a few new things. Some will work, some won't, but you can make your family happier and make everybody in your family happier.
One of the really interesting, and there's many interesting pieces in this book, was that we typically think that when guys come home to their families, they don't really want to be there. And when women come home from work to their families, they're delighted and relaxed. And it might be the opposite.
The highest stress time in families is between 6 and 8, right? So in general, the two highest stress times are the first hour after everybody wakes up and the hour before everybody goes to bed. But this end-of-the-day window and what the researchers, these researchers in Chicago who gave people buzzers and buzzed them and said, what are you doing and how do you feel, found that men pretended that they hated to go home, but really they liked it. And women were particularly stressed because of the second shift, right? The idea they were working during the day. Many of them, we know two-thirds of moms work outside the home now, but they were coming home, and then they had what's called the second shift, this new layer of work on top of them. So, in fact, moms and dads are becoming much more equal in what they do around the house, but still not yet totally equal. Moms are still doing more. But I do think that this changing, one of the reasons for all the change in family life these days, especially from, say, when I was a kid growing up, is that moms are working and dads are much more involved in home. So the kind of traditional boundaries between work and family, that membrane is really kind of more open than it's ever been, and we're trying to figure out what the new rules are.
We will talk much more with our guest this morning, Bruce Feiler. He's the author of The Secrets of Happy Families and many other bestsellers when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Cohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or akfel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as Wildly Popular Jewish Podcasts. Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in going with me on this great journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Masada to Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or call 327-4501, that's 520-327-4501, for more information and an itinerary. We now continue our pre-Pesach preview of Passover music with a song from my dad and me, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, a mini medley of two Passover tunes, Bechol Dor Vador. In every generation, each of us should see ourselves as though we personally had come out of Egypt. And Shalach Ami, Moses' words to Pharaoh, let my people go.
Bechol Dor Vador, Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Keilu Yatsa Mim Mitzrayim.
And now it's time for a recurring, inscrutably irregular feature of Too Jewish, Haikus for Jews, the wisdom of Zen Judaism. The Shiva visit. So sorry about your loss. Now, back to my problems. And beyond Valium. Peace is knowing one's child is an internist. That was the eternal wisdom of Zen Judaism, Haikus for Jews. We welcome our Mivinar expert on Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We began talking last week about some of the ultra-Orthodox who choose not to serve. They have a yeshiva exemption and don't go in the military. But there's a bit of a controversy in Israeli society about some of the chilonim, the secular Jews, who also maybe don't want to serve, don't have that same idealistic connection to Israel that was so central to Israeli identity. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. If I would say 30, 40 years ago, you would see at all the high units in the IDF, you would see mostly
Sayeret Matkal,
and all the other
the paratroopers, the top units,
and you would see mostly young adult from the secular kibbutzim. Now you would see most of them with kippah sruga. How do you call it?
Modern Orthodox.
Exactly. Yeah, and some of them like.
It's interesting, kippah sruga is the knit kippah. I happen to wear one, although I'm not modern Orthodox. Yeah. And then there's the kippah shchora, which is the black velvet one, and they're not modern.
Yeah, so it's the modern. Yeah.
But many of the top units are now modern Orthodox.
So, and right now, most of the high unit, like, as you said, Sayeret Matkal and others, will be modern Orthodox. And some of them, even kids of families that were, evacuated from Gaza to Israel or from the Yehuda Veshomron.
From
the settlements,
and Samaria, from the West Bank.
So it's really interesting. But for me, it's like, it makes sense because their ideology, they connect very much love and connection to Israel, so they will defend it. They will do whatever they need
necessary.
Yeah, and many of the secular Israelis won't serve in a very meaningful duty and will prefer to do shirut leumi, a national service, like for a year or two, sometime abroad. Sometime they will do it, in a Jewish community abroad, and will prefer not to serve at the army.
So it's a major societal change. In every society, the old timers say, the young people aren't like us. They aren't tough like us. They, if they went into battle, they wouldn't have the same success. But actually, there is a kind of attitudinal change in Israeli society.
Yeah.
Is it also related to the fact that it's such a high-tech army in some ways now that it takes a lot of people with specific skills? Not so much.
Huh? No. I would say it relates to two topics that I define them the main threat on Israel. It's all the social gaps that we have in Israel, and the second one, it's the less Jewish identity among Israelis.
So Israelis thinking of themselves as Israelis, not necessarily as
exactly.
Jewish Israelis.
Exactly. They think that there is like something that called Israeli identity, and I don't think there is something that called Israeli identity without Jewish identity. What does? And we can
Let's
continue.
Talk about that next
week.
Thanks, Ashrat. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. You can help send kids to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your state tax dollars instead to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. The state allows its taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not just a deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade who go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson JCC Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income taxes, make your contribution to JETCO, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your state income tax return. Tax credit, not a deduction. There's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit, this year. You can go up to $1,031 to JETCO for a single filer, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we need every dollar we can for Jewish education, this is the time to make a contribution to JETCO. Do so by calling 647-8442, that's 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web, jetco.org. Give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Ukraine, but also kind of all of that wedge of countries that used to be part of the Soviet bloc, some of them actually part of the Soviet Union, now all independent. Let's talk about Ukraine and Belarus, White Russia, the two kind of major flat countries that were really under the Soviet control and now are independent and certainly interesting places where so many Jews, my own family, some of them came from Minsk in Belarus, lots of Jews
Minsk,
in America came
Pinsk
from there.
And Semipalatinsk,
that's
as they
it.
Say. Right. So, as I said last week, Ukraine and Belarus have, for better or for worse, the distinction of being fellow Slavic countries. So Russians have been traditionally much more involved and much more reluctant to give up control. Belarus has always, even in the post-Soviet period, remained very, very closely tied to Moscow. And if anything, more traditional right-wing hardliner than Moscow itself, certainly pre-Putin Moscow. Ukraine is different in a sense. It's huge, both in terms of area and in terms of population. If it were really part of Europe, it would be one of Europe's largest countries and potentially an economic and agricultural powerhouse. However, Ukraine has been plagued by decades of mismanagement, first by, well, maybe centuries, first by the czars, then by Soviet leadership in Moscow, and now by a series of short-lived governments which often seemed, although not always, to be more interested in lining their own pockets than anything else.
I have a friend who does a lot of business in the Ukraine, and the level of corruption is spectacular.
Right. And the currency is very unstable, and there are lots of problems with post-Soviet history of Ukraine. But one of the fundamental problems that your listeners may not be aware of is that basically west of the Dnieper River, the majority of residents are Ukrainian speakers and very pro-Europe, pro-West. They see themselves as having been oppressed or suppressed or repressed and somehow slowed down by their historic ties to Russia. East of the Dnieper River, the majority of the population is Russian-speaking and would be happy to be part of Russia and were ambivalent about the idea of an independent Ukrainian state from the very beginning. They would feel safer in a Ukraine that was very closely allied with Russia. So a lot of elections in Ukraine have nothing to do with politics or the integrity of government officials. They have to do with Russian speakers versus Ukrainian speakers, and with an orientation more towards Moscow or more towards Brussels. Besides that basic division between East and West, there's also the special case of the Crimea, which we should discuss in particular next week, because that's where Putin sent troops, and that's where, if anywhere, war could break out.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe Cohen is 82 years old. He makes an appointment with Dr. Levy, well known for his work in curing impotence. Dr. Levy examines Moshe carefully from head to toe and says to him, "Mr. Cohen, I've examined every part of you. I can honestly say that you're in excellent condition for a man of your age. So tell me, why are you really here?" And Moshe replies sheepishly, "My friend Bernie tells me he makes love to his wife 10 times a week, and I can't do that, doctor." The doctor smiles and says, "Yes, you can. You can also say you make love as many times a week as you like." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Metzorah focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease in the ancient world, but mostly an archaic and pretty disgusting section today. It's true, leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated, if at all possible, in particular by using the concept of quarantine to isolate it. but exploring what our ancestors several thousand years ago believed to be an infectious disease at great length in a Shabbat service can scarcely be called spiritually uplifting. Well, the rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem a long time ago. They came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word mitzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, in a kind of abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, motzi shem ra, which means to slander or to do evil speech. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, that awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. Commit no slander, and your own life can be cleansed of moral illness. There is a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poison tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected illegally. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and not legally admissible. So it is in Jewish tradition with mitzorah and all other forms of lashon hara, evil speech. Whether or not the gossip has elements of truth in it, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupted source. It must be ignored and not repeated, the rabbis say. Our own ethical goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency we all have to speak ill of others. Commit no slander, and your own life can be clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that damage others, we can find our way to living clearer, cleaner, better, holier lives. In the portion of Mitzorah this week, the Torah even delineates forms of Mitzorah that affect the very houses in which we live, called Mitzorah Bait. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. Kind of along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's famous statement that a house divided against itself cannot stand. Well, if we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations and synagogues and communities in which holiness can flourish, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated. May we each do our part, this week and always, to remove mitzorah, personal impurities of speech and action, from our own lives. Journalist and author Bruce Feiler has navigated walking the Bible and many other worlds in writing a series of New York Times bestsellers and hosting some TV series. Now he enters the challenging arena of trying to create happy families, and his insights are both surprising and amazingly practical. Hear what he has to say. Find out how it can help you when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Robert Strauss, the Jewish former chairman of the Democratic Party and an ambassador to the Soviet Union, among many other high offices, died last week at the age of 95 in Washington, D.C. Bob Strauss was born the son of German-Jewish immigrants in Texas in 1918. He graduated from the University of Texas Law School, was an FBI special agent through World War II, and later co-founded the huge international law firm known today as Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer & Feld. A volunteer in Lyndon Johnson's first congressional campaign way back in the 1930s, he was a close friend of Texas Governor and Secretary of the Navy John Connally and a longtime political power broker. Strauss was chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 1973 to 76. He was credited with bringing the party back from the political wilderness of the McGovern debacle in the 1972 elections. Strauss also guided the presidential campaigns of Jimmy Carter. During the Carter administration, he very successfully served as the nation's trade representative and as a representative in Middle East peace negotiations. Bob Strauss was ambassador to the Soviet Union and then to the Russian Federation during the George H.W. Bush administration, the first Bush. Barbara and I mourn the passing of a Texan of legendary influence whose lifelong devotion to the Democratic Party never precluded his ability to work across the aisle on matters of national importance, the first President Bush said. He was a particularly effective advocate for America's interests during that tenuous time as the Soviet Union imploded and a democratic Russia emerged. Most of all, Bob Strauss was a friend, and we already miss him dearly. Bob Strauss never really retired. He ran Del Mar Racetrack late in life, for example. He was a legendary figure, not only in Texas politics, but in American politics. A true Jewish Texan original. May he rest in peace. May his family have comfort. In a small good news update on the Nazi art scandal coursing through Europe these days, a Norwegian museum has agreed to return a Matisse painting once looted by Hermann Göring. It's going back to the family of Jewish art dealer Paul Rosenberg. The 1937 painting, Woman in Blue in Front of a Fireplace, has been the centerpiece of the Henny Onstad Art Center near Oslo since the museum was established in 1968 by shipping magnate Niels Onstad and his wife, Olympic figure skating gold medalist Sonja Henny. The museum said in a statement that although it acquired the painting in good faith, it has chosen to adhere to international conventions and return the painting to Rosenberg's heirs. Norway is a signatory of the 1998 Washington Conference Principles on Nazi Confiscated Art, which requires museums to review their collections for potentially looted works, and when such a work is found, to try to locate rightful owners. Now worth an estimated $20 million, this painting was taken by Göring after Rosenberg fled to New York in 1940, sold to a Parisian art dealer later convicted of dealing in Nazi looted art. It was acquired from a different gallery in 1950 by Onstad, who was unaware of its provenance. The museum investigated the painting's past only after being notified by the Rosenberg family of their claim in June of 2012. The museum said that in the wake of the investigation, which it believes is the first of its kind undertaken in Norway, called upon the country's government to establish a committee to actually meet its obligations under the Washington Principles. Similar reviews have been launched in the U.S., the Netherlands, and Germany. Ultimately, it was the strength of the moral claim that persuaded the Henny Onstad Art Center to restitute this painting unconditionally to the Rosenberg heirs, said Chris Marinella of Art Recovery Group, a lawyer representing the Rosenberg family. Fiddler on the Roof, arguably the most performed Broadway show in history, celebrated its 50th birthday last week, half a century after the nostalgic view of the shtetl reflected through Sholem Aleichem's great stories of Tevye the Dairyman became an unexpectedly huge Broadway hit. The show itself has now become the subject of great nostalgia. In an era of increasingly assimilated American Judaism, Fiddler remains a kind of memory of a memory, a reminder of how we saw our own history and heritage. After 50 years and uncountable productions in every language all around the world, Fiddler on the Roof remains touching and poignant.
If I were a rich man, yeah, 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 yeah. All day long I'd pity, pity, bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard.
With music by Jerry Bock, lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, and a book by Joseph Stein adapting Sholem Aleichem, Fiddler was the first musical to run for more than 3,000 performances on Broadway, when Broadway was really still king. It won 9 Tony Awards, has been revived 5 times, and adapted, that is on Broadway alone, and adapted into an Oscar-winning film in 1971. and it will be revived again for a new production next year on Broadway. In honor of Fiddler's big celebration, L'chaim.
Drink L'chaim to life, L'chaim.
L'chaim.
L'chaim, L'chaim to life. It takes a wedding to make a say. Let's live another day.
Drink L'chaim to life.
And our We Can't Really Believe It's True department tells us that Ritz Crackers' new bacon-flavored versions are actually certified kosher dairy by the Orthodox Union. There was much discussion over the decision about this product, said Rabbi Moshe Eliphat, the COO of the OU Kashrut Department. The box for the new Ritz Cracker has the OU dairy certification symbol, however. The reality is there's nothing close to bacon in this product, Eliphat said. There are artificial bacon flavorings that give the bacon flavor. There is no meat. Nobody is going to think this is actual bacon, he added, noting the packaging, which has the words artificially flavored in large type right below the word bacon. At least one reviewer says the new Ritz bacon-flavored cracker tastes like the real thing. These actually taste too much like bacon, commented Rina Raphael, style editor for NBC's Today Show, who sampled the Ritz crackers before they hit the shelves. Rina Raphael sounds Jewish. Well, that's not the sort of claim that people at the OU agency can verify that it tastes like real bacon. We're not in any way saying it tastes like the real thing, Eliphat said. That's not at all what our certification represents. Thank God. But next, we might have bread-flavored matzah for Passover. Anyway, that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, Bruce Feiler. He's the author of the new New York Times bestseller, The Secrets of Happy Families, Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. Perhaps best known for Walking the Bible and a variety of PBS specials and many articles for, well, lots of places. Good morning and welcome back, Bruce. Quick question for you. You went to, like, the Harvard Negotiating School. Tell us a little bit about that. It's a great story in the book and what it has to do with families.
25 years of research has shown one thing above all, which is to say all families have conflict. It's how you manage and respond to that conflict that's going to determine whether you're working as a family. So, you know, don't worry. You're not the only one who's finding it difficult to make work. And what particularly prompted this experience was when our kids were young, I'm the father of identical twin girls, we would put them to bed about 7:30. My wife would come into my office, which is right next door, and then it was about, you know, I used to call it we used to have what I called the 7:47 fight, where we would be talking about who's picking up the milk and who's taking grandma to the eye doctor and who's got the cleats for soccer practice and what are we doing for Thanksgiving. And then we just would be at loggerheads and my wife would storm out of the room. And I thought, how can we be a happy family if we have this bout of unhappiness every single night? There must be a better way. So this is an example, I think, of how we need to change how we look at families, because the instinct is to say, oh, it's the same, you just love them and everything will work out. That's sort of people's sort of generic response to families. Well, when Dr. Spock was writing about families in the 50s, there was no field of negotiation studies, and that's become a huge field of, like, how people get into fights and especially how people get out of fights. So I went and took this three-day seminar from the folks at the Harvard Negotiation Project. It was begun in the 1970s, and it's really, they do everything from Israeli-Palestinian peace talks to nuclear, not that those are going so well, but nuclear arms treaties. I thought, you know what, they should be able to help me. And again, the first thing that they taught in that seminar was they asked a bunch of people, all these people had paid $10,000 to be in this room, and I was a guest, fortunately, and they said, you know, how much time do you spend negotiating? And all these business executives said, you know, 70, 80, 90% of their time. And then Bill Urey, who was running the session, said, well, how much time do you spend practicing negotiating? Answer, zero. So the point is, you can learn things. And so we learned a lot. So for my wife and I, we learned a couple of things. I would say, number one, these fights that we were having every night, I was sitting at my desk right? So I've got my computer equipment, a big desk, I'm in a chair, I'm sitting up high. My wife is in this old IKEA chair I had in college, right? It's kind of broken down in the corner. She's like a foot below me. And we had somebody walk through our house who said, you know, you're in the power position and she's in the weaker position. Well, never occurred to me there's such a thing as a power position. So we have changed where we have these conversations. We do it on equal level, preferably on cushioned surfaces. We do it in our living room. We don't do it at this time of day because we learned that 6 to 8 is so high stress. So that was the worst time of day to having these conversations. But what the Harvard people in particular taught us, and we actually now do this with our kids. I speak a lot about families around the country now, and on almost every session I do, somebody will say, well, what do I do about sibling rivalry? Well, here's three things you can do that's kind of a watered-down version of the Harvard technique. So number one, when the kids get into a fight, and by the way, kids between 5 and 12, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they get into something like 4.5 fights every hour. That's a good hour, by the way.
Wow.
Separate them. Okay, in negotiation speak, the phrase is go to the balcony. When you're in the middle of a conflict, try to separate the parties, give everyone a chance to cool down, right? So if you're an adult, you say, look, I need a cup of coffee, or I got to go to the bathroom, or I need to quickly make a phone call, something to lower the stress. And what the negotiation people say is go to the balcony, look back on the scene as if it were happening on a play on a stage, and look down to try to kind of analyze what's going on. Second, come up with alternatives. So if our kids are fighting over, I don't know, a magazine or a book or whatever, my toy, we say, okay, come up with three alternatives to solve the problem. And if you give them, say, 5 minutes to do this, I guarantee you they'll spend the first 4 minutes and 58 seconds saying, my way is the only way. She's got to do what I want, or he must listen to me. But then eventually they'll break down. Eventually they'll come up with three alternatives. In negotiation speak, this is called expand the pie before you divide the pie, come up with more solutions. Then you bring them back together, you put all of the solutions on the table, and at that point the oxygen is out of the fight, and usually within about 30 seconds there turns out to be overlap, and then we're moving on to the next situation.
Okay, so I'm going to pull in some of my own experience. I am the father of three teenagers right now.
Mm.
And I used to really, really like them. I still love them. But what does a parent do, or what's a secret to a family where suddenly everybody plunges into a phone or a laptop or a device and disappears from social interaction?
Well, two things come to mind. Let me just talk about the technology thing. I think the first thing is I'm going to take your fear and make you feel even more fearful, if I might.
Oh, good. I can hardly. That sounds so Jewish somehow.
You're not even miserable enough.
Darn it.
Let me tell you why you really got to be concerned. And that is, I met a professor at Stanford who talked to me about the fact that he was a dorm parent at Stanford, and he was talking about his research showing that girls between 8 and 12 and boys a little bit older learn to read nonverbal communication. Okay, that's an important life skill, but it's an important life skill that young people today are not learning because they're spending so much time looking into screens. And he said one of the reasons that young, you know, sort of teenagers, young adults, spend so much time group dating followed by hooking up is because one-on-one stimulation, like if you are sitting there looking at someone in the eye, is overstimulating to them because they're simply not used to it. So you're going to need to set some rules of, it's not just don't turn off, you know, don't look into your device. It's not that the devices are the problem. The problem is there's not enough face-to-face time. So I think rather than sort of blaming the device, I think in some ways the solution is come up with activities that are enticing enough that will get them to turn away and participate in the group. And the other thing that's important about that is to examine your own behavior. Are you sitting there looking at your device, telling them not to look at their device? So I think you simply must have activities of some kind that are group activities, that are promoting contact. And by the way, with teenagers, it's often much easier. Listen to what this professor told me. It's much easier, this incredibly interesting group of ideas out there, which I do mention in the book, that it's easier to have these conversations often if you don't look them in the eye. So if you're driving, if you're taking a walk, if you're folding the laundry, if you can come up with an activity where everybody is participating but not staring in the face, it's going to be easier for them to participate and it won't be too overwhelming.
So
that's the first thing that I want to say. The second thing that I want to say is that when kids get older and they get schedules get more complicated, it becomes even more important that you have at least one time a week where you're all getting together as a family and talking about how you're functioning, right? So that's this family meeting idea that I feel very strongly about, where we do it now in my family, 20 minutes every Sunday night. We ask three questions: what's working in our family, what's not working in our family, and what will we agree to work on in the week ahead? Maybe mom's got a business trip. Maybe one of your kids has a big sporting match. Maybe somebody's got a big exam or an SAT or something. And everybody needs to adjust in order to accommodate what's going on that week. And with teenagers, if you walked in tonight and said, okay, we're going to start having a family meeting and we're going to start, maybe we'll do it on, you know, Friday afternoon before Shabbat, or maybe we'll do it on Sunday night or Monday, whenever it might be, your kids are going to roll their eyes and they're going to say, no way, we're not going to do that. We're too cool. We're too independent. But here's what's going to happen. What's going to happen is, let's just say Thursday night at around 11 o'clock, right when you are flossing your teeth and balancing your checkbook and trying to prepare for the presentation you're going to make the next day, and you need to check in with your grandma to find out how her visit to the doctor went. At that moment, when you are at your most vulnerable, your teenager is going to come in and say, oh, by the way, I need to be at Susie's house on Sunday afternoon, and I didn't tell you, and I have to stay out past my curfew, and I can't come to grandma's house with you. I hope that's okay. And at that moment, you're at your most vulnerable. They know that. And you're going to say yes because you just don't have time to pick the fight. And at that moment, if you say, you know what, I can't do this right now, you're springing this onto me. If you come to the family meeting with that issue and everybody can adjust and talk about what it means for everybody in the family unit, then that will work. And I guarantee you they'll be the first one at the family meeting because they're going to see that it really affects them.
So I'm going to ask one last question about bar and bat mitzvahs. B'nai Mitzvah, speaking not only as a rabbi but a dad who's taken three kids through this process. What did you learn, not necessarily in the book, but what did you learn in preparing this Secrets of Happy Families that helps with that remarkable, extraordinary, fantastic, and unbelievably stressful process?
The most interesting thing in the entire book, to me, relates directly to this question and to religion in general, and that is that kids who know more about their family history have a higher degree of belief that they can control the world and a higher degree of self-esteem. The researcher who did this actually is a Jewish professor named Marshall Duke at Emory. I learned this at a Shabbat dinner at his house on a Friday night. And the core idea is when they ask kids, do you know where your grandparents were born, where your parents went to high school, or an aunt or an uncle had an illness that they overcame, those kids, it was the number one predictor. They compared a host of studies, the number one predictor of a child's emotional well-being. And the point is, you want to talk not just about the positive moments in life, but also the negative moments and how relatives overcame them. And that our instinct as a parent is to protect our kids, but we actually need to talk to them about the difficulties. And if you look at the core stories in the Hebrew Bible, certainly the core stories of Jewish people, they have to do with these ups and downs about how you respond to suffering. In the Bible, like the greatest breakthroughs are the moments when the Israelites are in exile or in the desert. It's because the difficult moments are important. And I think that what a bar and bat mitzvah can accomplish is to introduce a child just entering that period of identity formation that they come from a long history, not just the people, but also from a family, and get over your instinct to protect your children. Fling open the closet doors, bring out the skeletons, tell them the good and the bad, so that when they hit a hurdle, they'll have the confidence that their relatives overcame it and that they can overcome it too.
I want to thank Bruce Feiler for a great visit. The book is called The Secrets of Happy Families. I can tell you it has a good deal more in it, even than we were able to cover on Too Jewish. Bruce, thanks and best of luck.
Always great to be with you. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique,
Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us on Too Jewish This Morning with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Bess Sirdut, speaking about the modern Talit. Our playout this morning comes from our wealth of great Passover tunes, with Pesach coming up in just over 2 weeks, beginning on the evening of April 14th. This one is from Safam, wonderful group, and it's their version of the Passover psalm, Betzeit Yisrael, when Israel came out of Egypt. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Betzeit Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, Bet Yaakov me Amelo. Hayta Yehuda.